Welcome to another in our series of Kehillat Israel podcasts. This is a recording of Rabbi Amy Bernstein's weekly Friday morning Torah study.
So we are still in the book of Exodus, coming to the end. We are in Vayakhel. Often it's read together with Parshat Pikudei. But this year they are separate parshiot. So we are in Vayakhel from the verb kahal, from the root kahal, but it's the verbal form. So kahal, like kehilat, right? So community, congregation. So the verb of that Moses communifies the people. So that's what we're going to be looking at a little bit this morning. So the beginning of our parsha, Vayakhel Moshe et kol adat b'nei Israel. So Moshe convokes the whole Israelite community and says to them, Ela advarim asher tziva Adonai lasot otam. These are the things that God has commanded you to do, or I would say, do and or make. And the first thing we get, which is interesting, is the commandment for Shabbat. So on 6 days, here the English says work may be done. I don't love this translation. Sheshet yamim ta'aseh melacha. 6 days, you will do work. The English makes it sound like over and against Shabbat, you may work 6 days. That is not the sense of the Hebrew. The sense of the Hebrew is sheshet yamim ta'aseh melacha. 6 days a week, you will work. Yes, like the expectation is you spend 6 out of 7 days contributing in some way to, right, to whatever field it is you are in. That it is a good thing. That engaging with the world is a good thing. Engaging with what's around us is a good thing. And then the disjunctive vav, uvayom ha-shvi'i, but on the seventh day, yiyeh lachem kodesh, Shabbat Shabbaton Ladonai, right? So it will be set aside. Our root Kuf Dalet Shin is about being set aside. Shabbat Shabbaton, right? It is a Shabbat of complete rest for Yud Hey Vav Hey. And anyone who works on it will be put to death. This is a theocracy and a blatant violation of one of the primary laws of a theocracy is results in capital punishment. You shall not kindle fire in your settlements on Shabbat. And Moshe says, goes on to say, El kol adat b'nei Israel, to the whole community of Israel, Zeh hadavar asher tziva Adonai lemor. This is the thing that God has commanded. So there's lots of commentary written on why is it Zeh hadavar here. But up on verse number one, it's Eila hadavarim. So these are the things. And then we get to this verse and it's like, Zeh HaDavar. This is the thing. Kumitchem Truma. So you are to take from among you Truma, right? A gift. To Yod Hei Vav Hei. Kol Nediv Libo. Everyone who is voluntary of heart will bring it, the Truma, right? Of gold, silver, and copper. Also, what else can be a truma? Blue, purple, and crimson yarns, fine linen and goat's hair, tanned ram skins, dolphin skins, acacia wood. Of course, it's not dolphin skin. Oil for lighting, spices for the anointing oil and for the aromatic incense, lapis lazuli and other stones for setting, for the ephod and the breastpiece. And let all among you who are what? What's the Hebrew? Aha, good. Thank you, Bert. Chacham Lev. So those of you who are at the women's retreat with me, right, here is this idea that the heart is the seat of wisdom. The heart is not an organ that's about emotion in Torah. The lev is the seat of experience, the seat of thought, the seat of discernment, the seat of thinking and wisdom.
That's wonderful. I love it.
Right? So tell me more, Sarah. Why do you love that? Tell me what resonates for you about that.
Because it acknowledges the place that we hold dear for loving, that it's also true for our tradition.
Beautiful. So what if, when we're thinking about something and we're thinking about decisions we're going to make, what if we really did locate more of that discernment process in the place that is also about love? What would the world look like, right? It would look a whole lot different than the decisions we make, as my therapist used to say, you know, when your feet are here, right under your chin. Like, the, you know, that just there's nothing outside of like using rational reasoning. That's not the only kind of wisdom that we need when we're making important decisions, particularly ones that impact other people. Bert, Carol, I'm not sure which of you has your hand up.
Yeah, it's actually Bert. Isn't chacham kind of a very special word?
Not biblically.
Chacham, I mean, that it's what God made the world with.
Okay, you keep trying to bring your rabbinic stuff into my Torah.
Well, you're a rabbi.
So once we get some influence from the region and we're exposed to this idea of Sophia, that is where Chokhmah becomes a much more important concept. That is later than the Torah text. So in Torah Hebrew, in biblical Hebrew, Chokhmah is wisdom. It's valued, but it is not cosmic. It is not wisdom, capital W. That's later. But it is true that, yes, that's where the tradition is influenced and impacted by Greek thought and other philosophies that have wisdom, capital W, being kind of the, you know, before anything, there is wisdom, right? And certainly Kabbalah, right, has a lot to say about Chokhmah. But Chokhmah Bina Da'at, that's Chabad, by the way. Chabad, Chokhmah Bina Da'at. So those three sfirot, one of them being Chokhmah, one of them being wisdom. So it gets massively developed in Kabbalah. It begins in early rabbinic writing and early mysticism, but which is also rabbinic, but not here. So here it means wise of heart. For artisans, right, who are going to be making this stuff, how would you describe wise of heart if we're talking about people who are going to make stuff?
It's skilled, and it's just from your gut.
Skilled.
Talented.
Talented. Good.
Inspired.
Inspired. Beautiful. Beautiful. So that's close. All of those terms are closer to Chacham Lev than our translation. Right. Well, skilled is a decent translation, but I would say what y'all said is much more a full understanding of what Chacham Lev is. So everyone who's Chacham Lev, Yavau ve'asu et kol asher tziva Adonai. So they shall all come and make everything that Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh has commanded. Et amishkan, right, the tent, et ohalo, its tent, and its covering. So there are two layers to the Mishkan. There's the inner layer and there's the outer layer. So the inner layer is what the priests would see when they entered the Mishkan. The outer layer is what protects the whole business from rain and sun. So you need different kinds of materials for the inner layer and the outer layer. Its clasps and its planks, its bars, its posts and its sockets. The ark and its poles, the cover and the curtain for the screen. Wait till you see the parochet, the curtain that we're going to have in the new ark. So beautiful and inspired. The shulchan, the table, its poles, its utensils, and the showbread. The lampstand for lighting, its furnishings and its lamps, and the oil for lighting. The altar of incense and its poles, the anointing oil, and the aromatic incense, the angel screen for the entrance of the tabernacle. The altar for an offering, blah, 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 blah. The service vestments, 19, for officiating in the sanctuary, the sacral vestments of Aaron, the priest, and the vestments of his sons for priestly service. So the whole community of the Israelites left Moshe's presence. Vayavo kolish asher nas olibo. And everyone, right, whose heart was lifted, who excelled, v'chol asher nidavarucho, and everyone whose spirit was willing, was moved, brought truma ladonai, trumat Adonai. They brought the truma for Yudhei Vavhei, for the workings of the tent of meeting, and all of the sacral vestments. Vayavo anashim, al hanashim, kol nediv lev. Okay, look at this bizarre Hebrew. Vayavo anashim. So the men came, al hanashim. What is al hanashim literally? Mm. On the women.
What?
Thank you, Sarah. Like, were they riding piggyback? The men came on the women. Cause they didn't want to walk. Right? So this is bizarre Hebrew. So look at the translation. Men and women. Okay. Right. Like what? Like, clearly they do not want to deal with this Hebrew, right? Because it really makes no sense. So, but of course, don't worry. You are not going to go home going, huh? How could she leave us with that really bizarre Hebrew, right? Like,
wait a minute. Could it mean some sort of celebration?
And what would this mean about a celebration? That when they came on the women.
I don't know. I used to feel that way.
Right? So maybe this is like when we talked about last week, you know, it leads to dancing. You know, like maybe this is some kind of, right? In Sarah's mind, some kind of tribal celebration, right? That has contact, right? Between men and women. Maybe they're dominant in that contact. So they are literally on the, okay. It clearly is not literal. Right? Like this, they didn't come on the women. The women did not carry the men. So we're going to have to look at what the commentary does with this. Ah, so closer. Victoria, do you want to say something?
Just a question. What if, given the women followed when they were having their periods behind all of them all, maybe that was the only place they could work to assemble this stuff. So they literally came upon the women, you know, out and away to build all this stuff. That's just
okay. So Victoria's saying maybe the women are separated and the men kind of come upon them. Okay. We can maybe buy that.
Okay. Unclean time. And there was a lot more space out there, I would imagine.
Okay.
I would expect this is some sort of idiom.
An idiom.
It has been lost to time.
Right.
Searching for other X, all Y to try to figure out when this happens in other places and what would be defined by.
So sometimes what happens with al is against, right?
Yeah.
So sometimes they come al Aharon. The mob comes al Aharon. Well, against.
It could be that they came. If you want to import that sort of semantics, maybe the against meant that they were facing each other,
or
that they were coming side by side.
Okay.
I thought they came upon the women is what I was thinking about.
So you agree with Victoria that they come upon the women?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, agreed. But I'm almost sure it's a hapex legomenon. I'm almost sure this doesn't appear anywhere else as an idiom. I'm almost sure, but we'll see where it goes. All right. Blah, 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 blah. So what we know is it's men and women. Kol nediv lev, everyone who was voluntary, whose heart was volunteering. This is not compulsory. This is different from the half shekel that is compulsory. Everyone has to participate. This is kol nediv lev, everyone whose heart so moves them. All of these gifts are like our sanctuary renewal campaign. Right? To belong to the synagogue, you pay dues. That's compulsory. To build the new sanctuary, it will all be voluntary gifts. Okay? So that's exactly the same. Some things don't change. Right? So, so the Mishkan, everyone had to contribute half a shekel, so there would be one. But all of the beautiful things that are going to make the inside of it shine and be lichavodotif aret, for honor and for beauty, is going to be voluntary. Okay. So they brought an elevation offering of gold to Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh. They came bringing brooches, earrings, rings, and pendants, gold objects of all kinds. And everyone who possessed blue, purple, and crimson yarns, fine linen, goat's hair, tanned ram skins, and dolphin skins brought them. And everyone who would make gifts of silver or copper brought them as gifts for Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh. And everyone who possessed acacia wood for any work of the service brought that. V'chol isha chochmat lev, and every woman who was chochmat lev, who was all those words we used, biyadeha, in her hands. So every woman who is skilled, talented, gifted, experienced, inspired, with her hands, brought what they spun in blue, purple, and crimson yarns, and in fine linen. And v'chol anashim asher nasa liban, and all the women whose hearts were lifted up, right? That they're using the word excelled, right? In that, b'chochma, again, we get chochma. We get these, you know, very skilled, talented, whatever. Tavu, Dave, we're going to have another one here. Tavu et ha'izim. They spun, literally, what does it say? Verse 26. Tavu, they spun et ha'izim. They spun the goats.
Goats didn't like it.
So what? what should it say?
They spun wool.
They spun goat's hair into goat wool, right? So, but the Torah text is tavu et ha'izim. They spun the goats. Okay, so we're going to see what Rashi has to say about that. And the chieftains brought lapis lazuli and other stones for setting, for the ephod and the breastpiece, and the spices for the and oil for lighting, and the anointing oil and the aromatic incense. Thus the Israelites, all men and women, whose hearts so moved them to bring anything for the work that Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh through Moshe had commanded to be done, brought it as a free will offering to Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh. Just in case we are not clear that this is voluntary. And then, Vayomer Moshe Abnei Yisrael, Moshe says to Bnei Yisrael, Ru'u, see, cry Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh B'Shem Bezalel Ben Uri. God has called the name of Bezalel Ben Uri, son of Hur from the tribe of Judah, and has filled him with the Spirit of God, Bechochma, with wisdom, Vitvuna, with understanding, uvada'at, and with deep understanding, right? This is, by the way, chochma bina da'at. Chochma bina da'at, Chabad. This is the three sfirot that we talked about that later become concepts. Chochma bina da'at. He is filled with all three. Uvachom lacha, and every kind of craft. Inspiring him with inspiring thoughts to work in gold and silver and copper, to cut stones for setting, to carve wood, to work in every kind, right, of skilled design and crafting, and to give directions. So he's not only good at doing it, he's also good at management. He and Aholiab, son of Achisamach of the tribe of Dan, they've been filled with chochmat lev, right, in order to do all of this work, as workers in all crafts and makers of design. Okay, so let's just quickly remember our conversation from last week. So last week we talked a little bit about what was so offensive about the calf, right? And so we talked about all the gold. We talked about resonances from Egypt. We talked about like lots of things. And we come to the Mishkan, and we're getting all of these instructions for building something using a lot of gold and a lot of silver and a lot of copper and a lot of purple and a lot of royal blue and a lot of powerful magical blue and a lot of precious stones. So it's, right? It's an interesting juxtaposition. All of that stuff being associated with idolatry. And yet all that same stuff is associated, you know, a lot of resonances of royalty in both Egypt and Mesopotamia. Like all of that is still resonant here in the Mishkan. So it's clearly not a case, which you could conclude if we just stopped after the calf. You could conclude, all right, no beautiful stuff. This should not be about how things look, right? Our relationship with the divine should have nothing to do with expensive stuff and expensive metals and precious metals and artistry. We should be more Spartan. You could come away from the calf incident with that understanding of what biblical Israelites were supposed to be about in terms of their relationship to beauty and adornment. But that's not the case. The Torah goes to great lengths to describe the beauty and the quality of the stuff used in the Mishkan. And it would have been the most expensive materials there were. Right? So, and beautiful. Like these are beautiful colors in that culture, in the surrounding cultures. Gold, silver. I mean, that's just universally understood as when you're adorning the most important things and making the most beautiful art, you use your most expensive materials. So clearly that is not biblical Israelite culture, is that they can't have beauty in relationship to worship. Okay. But then what's the difference? So that is part of what we, and also rare materials, correct, right? So rare things, that's what you would have had, like when you're talking about your most special spaces and or adorning them. All right.
Very cynical sort of perspective on this.
Huh?
I have a very cynical perspective on
this. Well, Dave, please share your cynical perspective.
Well, for a written by God. But actually, it's sort of a manual for how to keep the Kohanim in the manner to which they've become accustomed. And you look at all of the sacrifices, the offerings, everything that's brought into the Mishkan. They had the power to exert an influence over the Israelites, and they misused it.
All right, so talk to me about how that has to do with... So are you you're suggesting this is written by priests? They create this?
Yes.
Okay. So then we could understand for sure why the most expensive stuff and why it would be permitted and why, right, why that would all be okay if it's written by the priests.
It would seem to be a theory that fits data.
And if you look at Leviticus, I wouldn't argue with that. Not so sure about Exodus. I'm not so sure this isn't an Israelite cultic memory, some kind of preserved tradition. And I believe it is influenced by looking at royalty and the magicians of the courts surrounding ancient Israel, right? So we know this is created in Israel. We know this originates in Israel. So Israel's looking around, right? Israelites see the cultures around them and see the royalty and see the magicians of the court and see that grandeur. And of course, that's their frame of reference for how you make your God's space the most special and your God's priests the most well-dressed that you can. All right. That makes perfect, as an anthropologist, that makes perfect sense to me. I want to go a little deeper to this idea of when is that artistic impulse, what parts of that are okay and what parts make it idolatry? Like there's a line somewhere at which point using all this expensive material and all of this skill became verboten. You know, like it points to idolatry. So like and I think that tension still exists right today. Like there's this instinct for beauty and adornment of our sacred spaces. And there is a point at which it can become, and we've talked about this before, it can become idolatrous, that you start focusing on that instead of what all of that is supposed to be glorifying, which is that which is beyond all of that stuff, right? The teachings about how to live, how to create a just and holy society, the force in the universe that we draw on to do that, right? That's what all of this stuff is supposed to be pointing towards. But often, and I don't think it's so cynical, actually, I think it's human nature that often that gets confusing and we confuse them. And particularly the folks at the top who control those resources that are given freely are tempted to misuse them.
That's one of the points of that book that I was just reading about magic and amulets and so forth becoming so ingrained in the procedures and the place that it's beginning to take over the reason that the place was built.
Yes. So this is why, this is one argument that we talked about last year when we were in Deuteronomy. This is one of the reasons, one theory is the reason for, to your cynicism, the reason for centralization of worship was to take sacrifice out of the daily life of Israelites, to minimize the power of the priesthood. If you centralize worship, they can no longer sacrifice in all of those cities and towns in which they live. Now your priests don't have so much influence on the people, and they're not taking as much meat and stuff from the people because now you've centralized it in Jerusalem. So it's a counterintuitive argument that I really like that says it looks like you're making sacrifice more important and the priesthood more important because now it can only happen in the temple in Jerusalem. But what you're actually doing is desacralizing meat eating the rest of the time in the rest of Israel. You're making it non-sacrificial meat. You're minimizing the role of the priesthood. Okay. And I almost prepared a whole shiur last time on the corruption of the priesthood, but I did not. Okay. Maybe next year. All right. So let's go to your sheets.
And does that happen in every religion?
What? The corruption of the priesthood? I don't think the question is, does it happen in every religion? I think it happens in every human endeavor. In every human institution, there is the temptation to corruption and there are those who succumb.
Yes.
So the righteousness of the institution depends on those willing to not benefit, right, and to stand up. So if we look at the prophets, that is the whole agenda of the early prophets, is saying, God doesn't want your stupid incense, whatever, you know, the priests get to really, you know, enjoy that. And the priests are taking what they want and arguing that what God wants is justice. What God wants is for you to clothe the naked and feed the hungry and protect the vulnerable. There's no need for prophets to be running around yelling and screaming about that unless you have a corrupt priesthood and folks being just fine with that, right? Just let them take what they want. As long as the house of God is standing, nothing will happen to us and we're good. And then I don't have to worry about justice, right? And building the social safety net. All right, so we're going to go to this. We didn't read it, but it's the same, right, idea. I have endowed, this is talking about Bezalel, that we just read about, but it's first mentioned in 31:3 that God says, I've endowed him with a divine spirit of skill, ability, and knowledge in every kind of craft, right? And we just read it again. We read the reiteration of Chokhmah, Tvuna, and Da'at, right? So here's Rashi. Chokhmah, wisdom, is what a person hears from others and learns. Vuna, understanding, is understanding a matter by one's own intelligence, deducing it from the thing one has already learned, the things one has already learned, And da'at means holy inspiration. So what does Bezalel have according to Rashi? Three different kinds of wisdom. One is the kind you learn at the foot of a master. Someone tells it to you and shows you and you learn it. The other thing Bezalel has, though, is an ability to interact with stuff out of one's own being bright and clever and deducing new things from what you've already learned, right? Having the ability to take that and do new things with it, to innovate, if you will, or to apply it in ways that you weren't directly taught to apply it. And da'at is inspiration, right? It's the thing you can't quantify, right? The thing you can't teach is, so Bezalel, according to Rashi, has all three.
Is that why the art colony or the village art school is Bezalel?
Yes. Yes. That is why it's named Bezalel. All right. So do you have Gold next? Okay. So Rashi explains, right? Rabbi Michael Gold is commenting now on Rashi. His comments give a deep insight into art. Chochmah is what he learned from his teachers. Tevuna is what he developed on his own through his creativity. And Da'at is the Holy Spirit, which flowed into him through the act of creating art. Rashi is saying that there are three partners in the creative process. There is the community, there is the artist, him or herself, and extremely important, there is the Holy Spirit that flows into the artist. Whether it is painting or sculpture, music or dance, poetry or prose, true art comes from a spiritual place. That real art, Gold is saying, Rashi saying, needs all three of those components. True art needs or has, as just by definition, has all three of these aspects to it. And I think we would agree. All right. So now we're going to go to 35, 22 through 26, which we read, if you'll recall. All those who hearts who moved them, right? They made an elevation offering. They brought brooches, earrings, rings, and pendants, gold objects of all kinds, the linen and yarn and blah, blah, blah. And all the skilled women spun with their hands. They brought what they spun, and all the women who excelled in that skill spun the goats. All right. So let's go to this bizarre Hebrew on how did they come? The men came al hanashim, on the women. Ramban says it means with the women. The meaning of this expression is that because donations of ornaments were more common amongst women and they all had these jewels, therefore they immediately pulled off their earrings and signet rings and were the first to come to Moses. And only afterwards they brought with them those men with whom they found ornaments. For the phrase al hanashim indicates that they were there first while the men joined later. Okay, so you have to love Ramban. This is Nachmanides. So Ramban is saying jewelry, even in that civilization, would have been much more common on women. So when they heard the instruction, take your earrings and your rings, like the women rushed to do it. And then they had to go find men who were wearing that stuff. And when they found men who were wearing that stuff, they brought them too. Right? So, but the women were there first, ready to give their gold. As opposed to, by the way, the calf, which commentary in Midrash says the women didn't give their gold. The men did. All right.
Let's look at that borrowed from the Egyptians.
Of course. That's how they have it. Right? Yes. They borrowed it on their way out of Egypt. Yes. Yonatan Strendi says, the construction of the verse is notable and odd. The phrasing Hanashim al Hanashim al Hanashim, the men upon the women, suggests that the women carried the men, brought them along with them, that they came first with their jewelry, and only then did the men bring their gifts. All of the emphases on the voluntary nature of the donations, the repetitions that only those who wanted to give did so, culminates in the idea that it is the women who are keen to give their valuables in the service of God, that the men were carried along by the enthusiasm of the women. Right? So, Dave, to your point that we don't see this other places, so you gotta make it up, right? Yeah. So this is how they're making it up, but I love that this is the direction they're going in, right? That it's, what does it mean the women carried the men? Their enthusiasm for giving to the project carried the men along, and the men then gave as well. What?
Yeah.
Right. I think it's actually more fun to like just make it mean what we want. All right. So Ibn Ezra on 35:23, and every man or woman. So now Ibn Ezra's going to comment on that. Did I mess you up?
It's the very bottom of
the very bottom. Yeah.
Very bottom of the second page, text number 7. Thank you, Hannah. If you can keep telling us where it is, because I'm in the new version on the screen. And every man or woman. In addition, the women spun the blue and purple, the scarlet, the fine linen, and also the goat's hair, a craft which required exceptional skill. So Ibn Ezra saying women were, this was probably a woman's skill, right? That this was associated with women. Because what he's saying, it's a very difficult thing. I don't know why. I don't weave or spin, so I don't know. But he says it's a craft which required exceptional skill. So this wasn't something just like everybody does, right? This is a very particular talent and craft. And apparently women were understood to be the ones who were masters of that, like knitting. Right. That it's a skill that women, right, would have been great in. All right. So, but let's see, using that language, let's see what the Talmud does with some of this. Our sages taught, remember I told you there's two kinds of curtains, the bottom one and the top one. The bottom curtains in the tabernacle were made of sky blue wool and of purple wool and of scarlet wool, Shabbat 99a. So text number 8 on your sheet. And of scarlet wool and of fine linen. And the top curtains were made of goat hair. Why?
Spring.
Huh?
Resist rain.
Good. So goat hair is going to be the way you, it protects goats in that environment, right? So you use what protects goats to protect the Mishkan. That makes complete and total sense. Right? We've been wearing furs as Homo sapiens for how long? If it's good enough to protect animals in this environment, it can protect Homo sapiens who don't belong in this environment. Because look at our skin. Look at our fur. Where do we belong? We belong once upon a time in trees, but where do we belong with this fur? Huh? We belong in very warm places. But of course we migrated to places where we are not suited, like Duluth, Minnesota, right? So we migrate to those places and we need what protects the animals in those places and keeps them warm. So right, this makes complete sense, right? Terrestrial human culture understands this, right? So, but why is it different on the inside? Why not just have the goat hair thing?
Beautiful.
It's not beautiful. So when you look up, you want to see, not that the Israelites were allowed in there, but when the priests look up, they should see something beautiful, not goat hair, right? Okay. However, the wisdom that was stated with regard to the top curtains, because remember we got Kol Hanashim Asher Natan Asher Nasa Liban, all the women whose hearts so moved them, right? And then we got, again, Kol Hanashim Asher Nasa Liban. So we get, B'chol Isha Chochmat Lev, every woman who is Chochmat Lev, and Kol Hanashim Asher Nasa Liban, and all the women whose hearts were elevated, meaning skilled. Why these two? The Talmud is saying, the first, all the women who are Chochmat Lev, refers to one curtain. The second, all the women whose hearts were lifted, refers to the other curtain. Which is which? The wisdom that was stated, the chokhmat lev of the women, that was stated with regard to the top curtain was greater than that which was stated with regard to the bottom one. Why? This is because with regard to the bottom curtains, it is written, and every wise-hearted woman spun with her hands, and they brought that which they had spun, which we just read, the blue, purple, and scarlet, and the linen. With regard to the top curtains, the Talmud is arguing, it is written, the next phrase, and all of the women whose hearts inspired them with wisdom and spun the goats. That's the top curtain. The phrase whose hearts inspired them suggests a greater degree of wisdom. Why does it do that? Well, it's not obvious, right? So apparently spinning the goat's hair curtains required greater skill than spinning the various kinds of wool. And on a similar note, it was taught in a baraita in the name of Rabbi Nehemiah. The hair was rinsed on the goats and it was even spun from the goats, which required a great deal of skill. So that's how the Talmud, you have to love the rabbis. That is how they deal with, they spun the goats. They spun it while it was on the goats. That requires a lot of skill.
And goats don't have long hair.
Right? So Rashi, in case we're unclear, Tavu et ha'izim, they spun the goats. So we always have to ask when Rashi's commenting, what's bothering Rashi? Right? This is how we were taught in rabbinical school. Whenever you see Rashi's quoting on three words, they spun the goats, you have to ask the question, what's bothering Rashi? What's bothering Rashi about these three words? The same thing that bothers us. What do you mean they spun the goats? Is that like cow tipping? Like they're just bored and like they're spinning goats? Like what? It doesn't make any sense. So Rashi knows that. Rashi knows that's not the right Hebrew. They've spun the goat's hair is what it should say. So what does Rashi say? Literally the goats. They spun the goats. This required extraordinary skill. For they spun the goat's hair from off the backs of the goats. And he's quoting the Talmud passage that we just read.
There's another phrase in here which stood out to me because it's the name of a novel I remember reading it years ago, an Israeli novel, with their own hands. Why would you even mention with their own hands? Whose hands are they going to use? And they keep using that phrase.
So I don't think the Hebrew says own.
With their hands. I mean, what else?
Because it's a, what do we call it? When, we have a term for that kind of stuff that's connected to hands. Handiwork. Well, what other thing? What, you did it with your nose? Why do we call it handiwork? Is it going to be nose work? Ear work?
Yeah.
Like, duh, it's the work, but it's because it's a skilled manual, you know, like, I think it's like handiwork. It's the work of their hand, right? It's, all right.
Spinning the goats. I mean, you know, the goats are being viewed as something functional. Like when you say you fry the chicken, you don't fry the chicken. You fry the chicken's legs.
Dave, I am not suggesting you have to have a problem with it. Rashi has a problem with it. Rashi has a problem with it. So what does Rashi do? Rashi quotes the Talmud, who had a problem with it. There isn't a baraita unless they have a problem with it. I don't have a problem with it, but the Talmud did. The Talmud is like, that's not how you say it, right? You don't say they spun the goats or they fried the chicken. Why doesn't it say they fried the parts of the chicken? They spun the goats? The Talmud doesn't like that. I mean, not that it doesn't like it. The Talmud's like, wait, we got to deal with this.
That's the purpose of the Talmud.
This is their pleasure, is to play with unusual wording in the Torah because it's a holy game. That's their craft. The women had handiwork. The rabbis of the Talmud have the words of Torah and their very clever minds and hearts. Sarah?
Is it possible that the women spun the goats while the goats were resting or sleeping and they didn't have to kill them?
Nice. So deal with them while they're like unconscious.
But even then.
And then they're not so much a problem and we don't have to hurt them and everybody's good. We're just going to spin it while they're sleeping.
Right. Love that. If you've ever been around goats, which I have, they don't sit still.
So I think that is why Rashi calls it an extraordinary skill. Because they spun it on the backs of goats that are not still. Right. All right, Victoria, what would you like to say?
Goat hair is extremely short, with rare exception. Yes. I can't imagine goats in the desert being some of the long-haired varieties. So I am suspicious that they're what someone just mentioned. They killed them. They had to have skins, goat skins, and the women were making the outer tent. It just makes no sense from a weaver point of view that you would spend your time on short hair.
Thank you, Victoria. Very depressing image of now slaughtering all the goats and making the mishkan. Thank you. Thank you for that. All right. It's like Silence of the Lambs. It's like, all right. Let's go to Ravko. Now we're going to start talking a little bit more about art. Let's talk about art in relationship to all this business. Okay. But I thought you would like the spinning the goats.
But they don't kill the goat. They don't kill sheep when they shear them.
They do not kill sheep when they shear them. Victoria is suggesting this is different, that when you shear sheep, it's not so hard to make wool, but it would be kind of tricky to spin goat hair into anything. It probably means the goat skin. Okay. Let's look at Rav Kook. This is from a letter supporting the establishment of the Bezalel School of Arts in 1935. And I love this. We are told that when God created light, remember, Vayihi Or, right? The first thing created is what? When is the sun created? Later. Thank you, Hannah. Later. So what the Or is on day one cannot be light that we know, the light of the sun, because there is no sun on day one. This has always been a question for the rabbis. I don't have a problem with it. They just need to comment on it all the time to point out that it's a thing. So there's lots of commentary. Rav Kook is going to pick up on a very famous commentary to talk about art. We are told that when God created light on the first day of creation, as opposed to the natural light of the sun on the fourth day, it was so strong and pellucid that one could see from one end of the world to the other. But God was afraid that the wicked might abuse it. So what did God do? God reserved that light for the righteous in the world to come. From another verse from Torah, Or Zarua Latzadik. Light has been like hidden for the righteous. So that's the light of the first day. It's been put away in the world to come for the righteous. But now and then, there are great people who are blessed and privileged to see it. I think that Rembrandt was one of them. And the light in his pictures is the very light that God created on Genesis Day. So a beautiful interpretation by Rav Kook that Or Zarua leaks into people who are extremely talented. And that light shows up in their art. So for him, it was Rembrandt. And the person who brought this quote was like, not sure what was up with Rav Kook and Rembrandt. Because Rembrandt like paints all these like regular people and
great images.
Well,
that's a no-no.
Well, so, but I think by the time we're talking about Rav Kook understands that it's not graven images. It's
Rav Kook's comment just above.
What did you say, Mark?
I think Rav Kook's comment above is worth reading.
We're going. Good. All right. Rambam.
Wait.
Rambam says, I understand.
Okay.
We're going to get there. All right. Rambam, one who suffers from melancholia may rid himself of it by listening to the, what? I did something wrong here. And all kinds of instrumental music by strolling through beautiful gardens and splendid buildings, by gazing upon beautiful pictures and other things that enliven the mind and dissipate gloomy moods. The purpose of all of this is to restore the healthful condition of the body. But the real object in maintaining the body in good health is to acquire wisdom. So this amazing quote from Maimonides who connects the beauty of art, of architecture, of agriculture, of music, of choreography, of all of this stuff. Rambam understands that this is how we address melancholia. And melancholia is what keeps one from a healthy physical being. This is where they're wiser than us in the industrialized first world West, right? That exposing oneself to this kind of beauty lifts a certain kind of depressive state that allows one to have full physical health. But the only purpose of that really is to live in such a way that one is acquiring wisdom. But notice what's going to get in the way of you of acquiring wisdom, right? Melancholia gets in the way of us acquiring deep wisdom. And the way you treat melancholia is to be around beautiful stuff. I love that. That's so ahead of like whatever, or what we tend to think of as their time. Yes, Bert.
And of course, Maimonides was a doctor.
Yes, and Maimonides was a physician, so thank you. Yes. All right, so Rav Kook, literature, painting, and sculpture give material expression to all of the spiritual concepts implanted in the depths of the human soul. And as long as even one single line hidden in the depth of the soul has not been given outward expression, it is the task of art, avodat ha'omanut, to bring it out.
That's so beautiful.
Isn't that so beautiful, Sarah? That is so beautiful. So what Maimonides is talking about, I think, goes well with what Rav Kook is saying, right? Because Maimonides is saying literature, painting, and sculpture, and all of the things that Rav Kook mentions here, and he means, of course, all the other artistic expressions, right, is actually spiritual concepts expressed. So, of course, according to Rambam, that would lift one's spirit if one is in a depressed spiritual state. You look at the spiritual expression of others, and that can help lift us, right? And as long as even one single line hidden in the depth of the soul has not been given outward expression, it is the task of art to bring it out. So not only is the artist someone who's creating art, art enables the artist to get out of themselves what's in there, stuck. Yes? I was just having lunch with someone who is a brilliant pianist, but she hadn't been playing or composing music for a long time. And she said she's now kind of obsessed. And like all she wants to do is compose. Like all she wants to do, she goes, I have so many songs in me. And I would hate to get to my deathbed knowing I didn't get them out. And like now when I'm doing other stuff, I kind of feel like this is all a distraction. Like I want to be at the piano getting these songs out. It's not about having them be famous. It's not about, right? It's about needing to get them out of her soul.
She belonged to this congregation?
She lives in the Palisades. She's Jewish. I'm working on her. So, right? So but I so thought of that when I read this, right? That it's, that the art is now also pulling from her what's hidden in there. So it works both ways, right? The artist both creates, but also the art itself, Rav Kook is suggesting, gets at what's hidden in us and pulls it.
I'm not sure there are two psychologists here that works in every case. I mean, I think it can, but I think that some of the greatest artists have been severely depressed.
Oh, sure.
And have never come out of it.
Sure. No, of course. No, of course. Of course. They're talking about regular people. I think they're talking about regular people that when we're depressed, go for a stroll in a beautiful garden. Go in the woods. Go look at contemplate something beautiful. Like they're not talking about tortured, you know.
You lose yourself.
Geniuses.
Doing something creative. You're almost right. Not there individually.
All right. So we're going to look quickly at Ibn Ezra on Bezalel. So what is Bezalel literally? Bezel and the shadow. Of El, of God. So his name is literally in the shadow of the divine. Kind of an odd name, but I mean, so let's look at what Michael Ibn Ezra does in this, in the introduction to the book In the Shadow of God by Chaya Rosen. In the Torah, God commands Israel to build a sanctuary so that the divine presence can dwell in their midst. The task of building a sanctuary that can actually house the divine presence requires a special, unique personality. Such a person was found. His name was Bezalel, whose name means in the shadow of God. This man was a great artist with the ability to create and be a channel for God's expression in the world. However, his gift did not just come from anywhere. Where did it come from? Judaism's mystics find the answers in the artist's name itself. They suggest that we not only read his name as in the shadow of God, but rather in the shadow is God. Whoa, right? Whoa. Bezalel's creativity and greatness came from his encounters with the deeper, repressed, hidden, and primal inner truths, Mark Fish and Mr. Siegel, Dr. Siegel. By going into these darker aspects of himself, he was able to embrace the light and liberate blocked energy for use in creativity and transformation. In other words, within the shadow is the discovery of the psychological and spiritual DNA of healing and recovery. Today, Bezalel is the archetype of the artist or creative personality, the person who must free the sparks of vitality from their darkened prisons and let them shine again. Like Bezalel, many of us, whether we will or not, are called upon to participate in a healing process that requires an effort of self, capital S, to gather the fragmented parts and weave them together to form a unified tapestry of meaning. Okay. Boom. Right? And Sachs, where there is much light, the shadow is deep. When art lets us see the wonder of creation as God's work and the human person as God's image, it becomes a powerful part of the religious life. Right? The Greeks believed in the holiness of beauty. Jews believe in Hadrat Kodesh, the beauty of holiness. Not art for art's sake, but art as a disclosure of the ultimate artistry of the creator. This is how Omanut enhances Emunah, how art adds wonder to faith. You gotta love Sachs, right? All right, so we can skip ahead. Although I do want to point out Jill Hammer talking about a certain wise-heartedness that folks on the margins, like those who we identify as queer, have brought to the world. Text number 18. So I just want to note that because I believe that's true for lots of folks who have been marginalized. But in this case, she's talking about queer folks. And again, we have this beautiful piece by Sachs. So I invite you to take that home and ponder it. And we'll close with Alden Saltboy for the gift of art, your final text. God, we give thanks for the gift of art, for pencil and paint, for glass and fabric, for metal and stone, for the gift that sees wisdom and beauty hidden in your works, for the skill and love that creates and crafts, releasing divine radiance for others to see. Hear this prayer for those who fashion art, revealing the secret glories of your creation. Make their works your vessel. Let heaven pour its vision through them so that they overflow with your light, drawing others to your glory. So that when we see their works, our souls turn back to you in appreciation. Together, we offer our gratitude back to heaven and rejoice.
You've been listening to Rabbi Amy Bernstein's Friday Morning Torah Study from Kehillat Israel in Pacific Palisades, California. For more information, go to our website, www.ourki.org.